You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
For the Grandest Tour, stage 32, and we're also joined once again by Ian Boswell. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Lionel.
Anything happening in the US, in the United States of America at the moment, Ian?
Oh, it's been a pretty quiet weekend here. Not much news to report on.
Okay, cool. Let's crack on then with the Vuelta.
I'm still eagerly waiting on results from my COVID test, but other than that, it's been pretty mellow.
Good. Well, you're I do hope we return to your fishing trip later in tonight's episode. I did enjoy hearing about that, but what a belting penultimate day of the Vuelta it was. It took a while. It was a slow burner, wasn't it? But we had some real excitement at the end of today's stage and some uncertainty for a moment. I also had a bit of anticipated nostalgia today, like the last day of a holiday. I was already kind of getting nostalgic for something I was still living, knowing that the Vuelta will come to an end tomorrow and that will basically be the end of the cycling for the year. I don't know, there was a lot to enjoy in today's stage. Have you got the headlines for us, please, Lionel?
I have indeed, Richard. Yeah, it was a thriller through the mist, wasn't it, to La Covatia. David Gaudu won his second stage of the Vuelta. He won on Farapona last weekend. Didn't have to wait too long for that second stage win. He was in the 34-man break that went clear early. Well, it all broke up on the way to the final climb. Up ahead of Gaudu on the final climb were Jon Izagirre of Astana, Mark Donovan of Sunweb, and Gino Meda of NTT Pro Cycling. Well, Gaudu had to bridge across, and he did so in quite impressive style. He joined up with Izagirre very briefly and then just went past him with around 4 and a bit kilometres to go and held on to win the stage. Meda was second. Izagirre, who also had won a stage earlier in the race at Formigal, if you remember, he was third. But that was not really the main story of the day, because there was another incredible finish to a Grand Tour. Remember this morning that Roglic led Carapaz by 45 seconds with Hugh Carthy loitering just behind. And on the final climb, it all really happened in the last 4 kilometres. Hugh Carthy tried to shake off Carapaz and Roglic, and then Carapaz tried to shake off Roglic, and he succeeded because he got away and was gaining time, but it was never going to be quite enough. Although Roglic must have had flashbacks to La Planche des Belles Filles, but he did hold firm this time. Didn't look entirely convincing for a little while, but he did manage to get over the line in time. Carapaz cut the Slovenian's overall lead to just 24 seconds. Hugh Carthy will confirm third place in the Vuelta tomorrow in Madrid. So after the last-minute turnaround at the Tour de France and a Giro that came down to a time trial to split two riders who were tied on time, this Vuelta also came down to seconds, because if you look at the time bonuses, Roglic's stage wins and other placings have given him 48 seconds in bonuses. Meanwhile, Carapaz took 16 seconds in bonuses, so a 32-second difference between them on time bonuses, but only 24 seconds splitting them in the GC. So it really has been a close race. Anyway, Roglic will repeat last year's Vuelta win when the race finishes in Madrid tomorrow. And what a comeback after the disappointment of the Tour. A few little changes in the bottom half of the GC, top 10 of the GC, I should say. UAE Team Emirates' David de la Cruz, who was in the break today, has moved up from 10th to 7th. And Gaudu has moved up from 11th to 8th, which nudges Grosjean, Valverde and Vlasov all down a couple of places. But as you say, Richard, it was another remarkable finish to the Grand Tours.
It was, and the second day of the women's race was also today. Lisa Brenner won a very short time trial, just 9.3 kilometres from Elisa Longo-Borghini, Ellen van Dijk third, and surprisingly, I suppose, Annemiek van Vleuten down in fourth. So going to tomorrow's final stage, Lisa Brenner is the overall leader by 10 seconds. Probably good to hold on to that tomorrow in Madrid.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWocker. If you run a business, find out more at iWocker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Let's hear from iWalker's Will Hayes, who was part of the recent charity London to Brighton bike ride they did, which went over Ditchling Beacon, of course, not Ivinghoe Beacon, as I said the other day. Apologies for that. Ivinghoe Beacon is not far from where I live, and I know it very well, but it hasn't featured in the Tour de France route. Anyway, Will had planned to ride the course on one of London's Boris bikes, but that plan had to change.
So as a sportsman, I was primarily a rower. While I was at university, I used to row for the Cambridge Lightweights. It's a pretty common trope that rowers, especially lightweight rowers, find their way into cycling. So I got my first row bike actually when I was doing some cross training for rowing. I've never really been a sort of full-time cyclist. You know, whenever I go on holiday, if there's some good places to do some cycling, I'll often rent a bike. We do a lot of retreats at iWalker. So we'll go away to various places, Sicily, Mallorca, as a team. And quite often we'll find some cycling to do there as well. We'd actually been planning to do, I think it's the British Heart Foundation's Brighton cycle this year, but unfortunately that couldn't go ahead. It was one of the suggestions that came up when talking about what we could do to raise money in relation to the attention that the Black Lives Matter campaign was having. The original plan actually was for me to do the entire cycle on a Boris bike, but that plan was ironically prevented by Boris himself when the six-person rule came in and we had to split our group into three groups of six people, and there was no longer space for me in the slow group. Luckily, James, actually, who you've also spoken to, lent me a bike, which was absolutely fantastic ride. I had a fantastic ride down to Brighton, sadly without any front derailleurs. It did not have enough gears to get me up Ditchling Beacon. Really made me question why I don't cycle more.
The ride was held to raise money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust, and as we've heard, iWalker is taking steps to improve the diversity within its company. If you want to find more about iWalker and the business of loans to small businesses, go to iWalker.co.uk. There's lots of information about what iWalker can do for your small business, as well as information from some of iWalker's customers.
Well, Lionel, you said in your news roundup that there was a moment, I suppose, of panic for Roglic or mild worry, but was that all it was? Or, I mean, Ian, did you think that there was a genuine threat to Roglic's lead? The gap that Carapaz managed to carve out, you know, he kind of immediately got 20 seconds. And on a climb, if you crack, you can lose a lot of time. It did get a bit easier right towards the top, but there's no question at all that Roglic was in difficulty. I must admit, my cloak of impartiality slipped for a moment. And I tweeted, "Come on, Rog," just because I couldn't bear to see him lose another Grand Tour on the penultimate day. I'm not a Roglic fan, but it just my heart went out to him a little bit. But did you think there was a chance of Carapaz doing it?
Well, yeah, we had mentioned that, or I had mentioned that last night, that, you know, will Roglic feel the pressure of being in a situation once again? You know, I was surprised at how late some of the, well, you know, particularly Carthy and Carapaz left it to actually put in an attack. But that said, you know, they were pretty isolated from, you know, relatively far out. They didn't have many teammates around. But at the same time, you know, we didn't, for the first time, maybe this season, we actually saw that Sepp Kuss was in difficulty. I saw you put out a tweet and I noticed the same thing. Yeah. I'm like, wow, Sepp actually swinging on the bike and, you know, he's not able to follow these moves. And I did think that there was a moment that I thought as well that Roglic was actually in serious trouble and he's gonna lose this again. And I'm sure running through his head was thinking, oh geez, this, not this again. But I do wonder if he was confident, if, you know, the team directors were in his ear saying, hey, you've got this, you know, ride steady. You know, the two Movistar riders, Soler and Enrico Mas, were kind of there to help and, you know, shelter him from the wind a bit. But when he crossed the finish line, you know, immediately he did a little fist pump. Which makes me think that he was in control. You know, that's probably not a, you know, emotion you would do if you were actually on the limit and unsure whether you were going to be able to keep the gap, you know, under 43 seconds. So I do think that while he did lose time, that he, you know, was still had maybe a little bit of control of what was happening up the road.
Yeah, I mean, that was the first time, other than the day when Sepp Kuss lost 10 minutes, that's the only time that he's not been able to step right up and just reel people in for Roglic. I mean, he basically, as soon as the pressure went on, he swung out of the line and Roglic was on his own. He did have Leonard Hofstadter, his teammate who'd been in that early break, who was coming back, not literally coming back, Richard, but he was being caught by the GC group. And there was, as I was watching, I wondered whether Hofstadter was actually a hindrance rather than a help, maybe a psychological help, but it didn't look like he was riding at the sort of tempo that Roglic would have needed just to dig in, limit those losses and just keep the gap steady. I mean, Roglic didn't need to perform miracles, did he? He didn't need fireworks in that situation. He just needed to not let the gap get to 30 seconds and then suddenly the pressure really would be on. So I think he did a pretty good job of just doing enough to win the Vuelta. And he did also perhaps have a little bit of help from Movistar. I mean, under the guise of Enric Mas, perhaps, trying to defend his position on GC, but I wonder how much of that was just Movistar not wanting to see Carapaz win the Vuelta. Well, yeah. I don't know.
I mean, there was this contrast in styles. Carapaz is, as I've said many times, such a dynamic rider. He kind of sits forward and he really punches the pedals, doesn't he? And Roglic, when he's in a little bit of difficulty, just seems quite laboured. He's such a fast pedaler most of the time, very fluid, but he just begins to look a bit more difficult for him. The contrast in styles was sort of, you were reading into that. And I think the gap went out, as I said, and then came back a little bit, especially as Enric Mas got involved. I'm not sure Roglic could afford to be as cool as that. I think that as long as someone's up the road and you're not with them, there is a danger. And it was Hugh Carthy that really lit the fireworks, wasn't it? He attacked, had a go, and Carapaz followed. But it's interesting because we had a question last night about, you know, what's the value in a team riding at the front and controlling things with Roglic sitting behind. And I think we kind of saw that today when George Bennett went and Sepp Kuss was the last man. And he clearly wasn't able to carry on that effort and those incredible performances we've seen from Sepp Kuss at the Tour and here. You know, he cracked as well, and with some kind of flick his elbow for Roglic to come through. And in that moment, you know, that was the moment where Roglic was vulnerable, and that was the moment that Carapaz got away. And it was, as Alex Ferguson, the Football Manager, said, squeaky bum time for Roglic at that moment. And he did do enough to hold on, and he did have a bit of a buffer. But it was, you know, to win a Grand Tour by so little is not as comfortable as he would have liked. I mean, if he'd been able to go with Carapaz, he would have gone with Carapaz. But, you know, we've seen Tour de France this year, 59 seconds between Pogacar and Roglic, 39 seconds at the Giro, and 24 seconds at the Vuelta. Incredible, really.
Ian, I've got a question for you, because it was all in the last 4 and a little bit kilometres, wasn't it, the GC action. Obviously, the distance on the screen was lower than that because that was referring to where Godu and co. were up the road. But 4 kilometres to go, do you think that, trying to put yourself in the position of Carapaz, do you think he would be thinking perhaps if he'd gone a kilometre earlier, he might have had time on his side, he might have been able to get the gap that he needed to win the Vuelta? Will he be kicking himself for not going earlier, or is it really a case of you can only do what you can do?
There's a few things at play there. I think, you know, you can only do what you can do, you know, and I think, you know, to be quite frank, I think that the fact that, you know, he was isolated and he didn't have a team there played factors in more way than one. Not that only could he not, you know, maybe they couldn't up the pace, you know, leading up to an attack, maybe, you know, 7-8K to go at the bottom of the climb, but also the fact that Ineos wasn't able to be there and actually control the race to the point where they decide, you know, hey, let's actually bring this back and go for the stage win. Because at one point the breakaway only had, you know, 1.5 minutes, and then it kind of went back out to 3.5 minutes. And you know, you'd mentioned time bonuses. You know, if Carapaz all of a sudden was going after a 10-second time bonus, that would change things as well. So, you know, it's similar to the stage in the Tour up to Mirabel when Jumbo wanted the break to go out, but Bahrain was able to bring it back to, you know, try and get Landa to get the time bonus. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy how close all these Grand Tours have been. And I think that, you know, in hindsight, maybe Carapaz is looking back thinking, you know, he wishes he would have tried to attack a bit lower, and maybe he and Carthy could have gotten away and worked together for a while and then dueled it out between them in the final, and the strongest rider would have gone away. But that point in time, Roglic was relatively isolated. But at the same time, I mean, he's been so consistent throughout the year. His team's been consistent. You know, the last thing you want to do is, you know, try to go up against him. And if they're on a good day like they normally are, then you're kind of on your back foot trying to hold on to him if they're able to respond to the attacks.
Richard, I wonder if the gap had been 3 seconds, we would have been talking about the stage where there was time gap gate and the 3 seconds that Roglic was given over Carapaz. I mean, it really was. You know, that incident was significant enough at the time, but it just shows you when the races are structured in such a way that they come down to seconds like this. I was thinking it on the final climb. You know, it's the proximity of the riders in the GC which creates the excitement and the drama, isn't it?
It's funny because these races have all come down to just seconds, and you can go back at the Giro especially, you know, Teo Gegenhardt lost a lot of time in that first time trial and on Etna and so on. It just, I don't know, just the circumstance of the race seemed to produce the guys at the top very close to each other. And there was a time bonus for Roglic yesterday, an extra 6 seconds that he had today that were, you know, in the end, quite valuable, really, in terms of giving him the confidence. Because if he hadn't got that, you know, the gap between him and Roglic would be 18 seconds, which is nothing at all. And the gap was up at one point between Roglic and Carapaz on the road to about 25 seconds. It did begin to look possible. It all depended at that moment on Roglic, really. But it did begin to look possible, and we might have had a real upset. Extraordinary, really, and a good effort by Carapaz. But as you say, I wonder if he's looking at himself tonight, wondering if he should have tried something a little bit earlier on the climb. But I think that moment when Kuss finally ran out of steam and George Bennett had gone, that was the moment. And had that come a bit earlier in the race, Carapaz might have done it.
Well, and I wonder too how much, you know, both Visma and Roglic are kind of perfecting their, you know, Grand Tour riding style. You know, Roglic has won, he won the Vuelta last year, he's going to win it again this year, but how they decide to take time, you know, for example, had Roglic not gone for the time bonus yesterday, but had, you know, maybe he saved more energy for today. Like, I mean, it's really hard to judge how much those efforts throughout a race make a difference. And you go after time whenever you can get it. And, you know, we saw that with Adam Yates a couple of years ago in the Giro, where he was going for every possible gain of time early and then he collapsed later. And I wonder how much Simon Yates. I race with both of them and I still get them confused. I still don't know who's who, actually, to be quite honest. Really trying to perfect, you know, what's the best method to win a Grand Tour and to manage your effort over 3 weeks, because, you know, different riders are going to have different physical abilities. But for example, you know, if you take a time bonus and take 6 seconds, but then you lose, you know, for example, today, 20 something seconds, you know, what's worth more in the end?
I do think, though, that Roglic, I mean, he's a worthy winner. 4 stage wins, 4 very different stage wins as well. 2 kind of punchy uphill finishes, 1 proper mountain stage. And the time trial, which finished up that incredibly steep wall. But I do also think, and this isn't sort of contradictory points of view, I do think he's been the strongest rider over the 18 days. But I do think if there was another mountain stage or two, and it was the same length as you know, regular Grand Tour, he might be, you know, coming down just as Carapaz is finding something to overtake him with. Having said that, that's all theoretical, because the 3 reduced stages are not mountain stages. So the balance of the race over the 3 weeks has been as it would normally be. The bit that was missing was the flat start in the Netherlands. So I'm kind of talking my argument down as I'm going further into it.
Lionel arguing with himself.
Roglic is the very deserving winner. But I think Carapaz can also count himself unlucky, really, that there isn't just one more day. I think if there was one more day, he might, you know, it's a bit like the US election. Roglic in red is Donald Trump. You know, he got the vote out on the day, but Carapaz has got all the postal votes. I don't know. Let's leave that one there.
As we saw at the Tour de France, Roglic is a very good loser as well.
That's true.
Well, yeah. And again, today at the finish line, the first thing he did when he crossed the line was, you know, went up and congratulated Carapaz for, you know, a good battle over the 18 or 17 stages. And, you know, it's good to see that he does have such good sportsmanship. And I think, especially in a time like now, you know, that's really important for especially young athletes who are watching the race, and just us human in generals, to acknowledge our opponents.
I agree completely. You know, and it is a point I was making flippantly last night, but, you know, that moment at La Planche des Belles Filles, when Roglic, who everybody expected to win the Tour de France, including him, and he'd been in control, or so it looked, the whole race, to lose like that was an upset, a disappointment for him. But to see the way that he reacted to that reflected very well on him. And I suppose that's what I was thinking today. I remember thinking, watching that at the time, that, you know, the next time Roglic was in a position to win a race like that, I would want him to do it, to see it through, because I thought his character showed in that moment, as it does in defeat. He responded very well and reacted with great sort of grace and dignity.
I mean, it's quite a run that he's been on, really. I mean, he's won a stage in every single Grand Tour that he started, and his run since 2018 is fourth in the Tour, third in the Giro, a win at the Vuelta, second in the Tour, of course, and a win in the Vuelta. I mean, you know, he is the dominant stage racer at the moment.
And yet, there are chinks in his armour, as we saw. We saw it at the Tour, clearly, but we've seen it here, and even at the Vuelta last year, on the penultimate day when Pogacar was away, there was a possibility that he might slip up that day. So he's not Froome-esque in the way that he's been so dominant that it sucks all the kind of drama or excitement out of the race.
Well, it's interesting how this, you know, in other years, this would have been such a close Grand Tour, but we've been treated to so many fantastic, you know, final few days of Grand Tours this year that it's you know, while the gap is still small, it does seem like, oh, well, he had a clear lead and, you know, everything's done and dusted. But, you know, it really was still a close race compared to years past.
I do wonder, especially when I was listening to Francois talking about the Tour route, and his assessment was that it's the most traditional Tour route for 15 years. I do wonder how the kind of the wider public would react to a Grand Tour that was won by sort of 4 or 5 minutes rather than, you know, handfuls of seconds. We have been almost spoiled, haven't we, by how close the races are. And the margins are incredibly fine. It's come down to meters, hasn't it? And, you know, that automatically guarantees a level of excitement. And the suspense has gone right to the end of all three races, you know, not only seeing riders, established GC contenders, but other riders breaking through as well. Hugh Carthy is a case in point in this Vuelta.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast since 2016. We're very grateful to them. And if you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP. 25. Will you have your Turbo Plus products for tomorrow's Zwift ride, Lionel?
I think I will, yeah. The last one of the Grandest Tour, 9:30. Well, the field is full now. There's 100 riders signed up for the ride. You'll be there, won't you, Richard? I think Rob Hatch,
I'll be there.
Adam, Will, Tom, our producers, Simon the photographer's riding.
Should be a great occasion. A great occasion. Where are we riding tomorrow?
Can't remember. I think we're on the France course. I mean, it's only an hour, so, you know, if you want to do your ceremonial champagne bit at the beginning, just get that out of the way.
Okay, well, we were chatting there. Ian, you had an interesting point to make, I think.
I spoke to a friend of the podcast and my friend Larry Warbass last night, who's now back in the US, back in Michigan. And we were just talking about, you know, the Vuelta and the Giro. You know, we hadn't caught up in a couple of weeks now. And he was at the Giro racing with, you know, Teo, and was just talking about how impressive his performance was there. And then we kind of got on to Hugh and how, while he's, you know, he's been a rider kind of knocking at the door. I think he was maybe 10th or 11th in the Giro last year, but, you know, that's a big step up to go from 10th place in a Grand Tour to podium finish. And Larry was just saying how really over the lockdown period, all these riders have had the opportunity now to finally, I won't say finally, but riders who maybe aren't GC leaders to actually be in one place and train like a Grand Tour leader, you know, really a team leader. You know, oftentimes riders of, you know, maybe Larry's kind of position in a team, or when I was racing my position in a team, you have a general outline of what your season looks like, but more often than not, things get shuffled around. You know, when I was at Ineos or at Team Sky, you know, Froome or Thomas, they change their schedule, and then, you know, my schedule changes. So, you know, my training for a specific race isn't necessarily perfect, or it's not necessarily clear. But this year, you know, so many riders, you know, Teo, Hugh, they've had this opportunity to actually focus on a single event and really prepare for that event without any distractions or interruptions, or, you know, any schedule changes, I think are the biggest thing. And there's, you know, personally, there were countless races that I went to over my career that I wasn't supposed to go to, and I got thrown in last minute, and I thought, oh, cool, I'll just use this as training for my next race. And it can become a very kind of dangerous cycle of where you're kind of constantly looking for the next race or using a race as training. And I think, you know, almost all riders this year approached every race as they're going there to perform, not to train to get ready for the next event.
Hugh Carthy was very interesting talking about his preparation and build up to the Vuelta in Life in the Peloton with Mitch Docker, because it kind of bears out what you're saying, an opportunity that perhaps wouldn't have been there for him had it been a regular season. Carthy, of course, rode the Tour de France, finished 37th, then went to the World Championships, and he was talking about how kind of tired he felt by that stage, was looking forward to just having some time at home. Then he was sent off to go and ride Flèche Wallonne, which, you know, wasn't something that he would have ordinarily have wanted to do. He was actually given the opportunity to not ride the Vuelta. He said that the team had got permission from the UCI to start with 7 riders instead of 8. So he kind of went home, trained, you know, took a bit of rest, then trained. You know, there wasn't a lot of time, so it was only a few days off the bike or a week of low key before he started training again. And because he had no pressure, no expectation, his appetite came back. And, you know, he really came into the Vuelta feeling fit, ready and raring to go. And he's ridden kind of the consummate race, really. 7th on stage 1. And he's moved up the GC, 6th, 5th, up to 2nd briefly. And then he's got onto the podium with that stage win at Angliru. Hasn't put a foot wrong. It's, again, perhaps not an opportunity he would have had had the season been conventional. You know, he might have come to the Vuelta not as the number one GC rider. There might have been somebody else. But because of the proximity of the races, a team certainly like EF Pro Cycling doesn't have perhaps the resources of or the strength in depth. They've had to be clever about who goes to which race. And, well, he's had the opportunity and he's really taken it.
It kind of makes a nonsense of the very scientific training and preparation that riders do to be at peak form. What he's done is he's suffered around the tour a little bit, certainly came out of the tour pretty tired, it seems, and then carried on racing for a bit and almost broken himself, and then, to his great surprise, found himself recovering quite well and feeling pretty good. There's no substitute sometimes for just a big block of work and then allowing your body to recover from that, and he seems to have been as surprised as his team to find himself in the sort of form he's been in at this Vuelta. You could say the same for Theo Gegenhardt, who was really focused on going to the Tour de France this year, really wanted to make his debut there, was very disappointed not to go. We've got an interview with him actually coming out next week for Friends of the Podcast, where he talks about this. A crash at the Tour de Lens really ended his Tour de France prospects, but that crash probably won him the Giro, because he wouldn't have been at the Giro if he'd gone to the Tour. So, you know, he hadn't prepared specifically for the Giro. And he said he'd started the time trial in Palermo with no adrenaline at all, because he was there just to get round safely and then do his job supporting Geraint Thomas. There's all sorts of curious things about this season. And as you said last night, Ian, maybe we'll look back on these races slightly differently in the future. But it's certainly thrown up some interesting performances and results and a few surprises. We should mention David Godu, who won his second stage today, of course. Young Frenchman, 24 years old now. He has been hotly tipped for a few years now. And he sort of continues a pattern of these promising French climbers doing really well. I mean, Warren Barguil a few years ago at the Vuelta. Maybe not delivering on that over time, but he's done a very similar thing here. He's a very, very stylish looking rider, isn't he? A natural climber. Maybe could be somebody who gradually kind of replaces Thibaut Pinot as the leader of that team.
Yeah, I mean, he's still fairly young, 24 years old, and he's been on the scene for a while now. But I mean, in this day and age of professional cycling, all of a sudden 24 seems like, you know, you're in the prime of your career compared to, you know, a few years ago when GC riders didn't really come to the fore until late 20s, early 30s. But yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with Groupama, because, you know, Thibaut's obviously still there, but they have the opportunity, or Gadou has the opportunity, to kind of fill some big shoes and could be the next French hopeful for that team.
He has signed up to the end of 2023 with Groupama FDJ, so he's there for a long time. I should say as well that we are presenting a Pedler de Charme mug, one of Stacey Snyder's beautiful mugs. I know you're the proud owner of one, Ian.
I am, yes.
Well, we're presenting one of Stacey's lovely mugs. She's made a one-off Pedler de Charme Vuelta mug. I asked for nominations today on Twitter. Godu was one of them. The others were Hugh Carthy, Chris Froome, Esteban Chavez, Willie Smith, Sepp Kuss, Dan Martin, Guillaume Martin, Will Barta, Remy Cavagna, and Tim Wellens. How do we get that into a shortlist of four is the question.
What about two semi-finals and then the final?
We'll do that tomorrow. I'll make an executive decision on who should be in the semi-finals. Who would be your Pedal de Charme, Ian?
I mean, to be quite honest with you, Richard, if you remember, I was on a fishing trip, so I didn't watch all of the Vuelta, but I did see that Will Barta came incredibly close to winning the time trial.
I knew you'd say
so,
Will Barta.
Yeah, he was my roommate for 2.5-3 years in Nice, and yeah, he's such a good guy, and you know, he works incredibly hard, so it was awesome to see him get the performance that he deserved, and hopefully that leads to a contract for next year, because he's still young and has a bright future ahead of him.
Just quickly on Gaudu, because again, this is just a sort of an impression from having seen him in breaks, not just in this Vuelta, but also in the Tour. Certainly in the Tour, he's often been the rider that's been up the road, and then he's been caught and passed. And to see him come from behind and catch and pass, you know, strong riders, Izaguirre, a strong climber, owed a certain amount to perhaps an increased sense of confidence that has come as a result of having already won a stage here. I don't know whether that's the case, but certainly sort of growing into those shoes of expectation. I mean, goodness me, what am I saying? That's not a phrase. But I wonder,
should be.
he's grown into the shoes of expectation, David Gaudu. And next year's Tour, of course, is, well, the Grand Depart will be very much a home fixture for him, because he's from Western Brittany, isn't he? And yeah, maybe he will step out of the shadow of Thibaut Pinot Groupama FDJ, if not next year, then over the next 18 months.
Well, another rider who was in the breakaway today, again, was Nick Schultz, who's keeping an audio diary for us. Let's hear again from Nick now.
Stage 17, almost there. One more day to go tomorrow. The second last stage of the Grand Tour almost always feels like the sort of the last hurrah before the parade into Madrid tomorrow. Crazy hard day today. Really bad conditions at the start of the stage. Yeah, we wanted to have representation in the break, and we did that with myself and Dion Smith up the road in a big group of 30. And there were some super strong riders in there. Guys well placed on GC, who had teammates present as well. So they basically set them to ride, and we were going super hard. It's one of the hardest days I've ever had on the bike, numbers wise. And yeah, it was just a matter of hanging on for as long as I could. Got there to the final climb. The group had greatly reduced by that point, and to be honest, the lights more or less just went out. I didn't explode or anything, but I'd just reached my limits by that point. After such a hard, slow burning grind of a day, there just wasn't much left that I could do against the caliber of climbers that were in that group, and battled on up the climb at my own pace to sort of finish off the last mountain of the 3 weeks. Got to witness Carapaz attacking Roglic, which is not something I get to do every stage, so that was also interesting to see play out. But yeah, very happy to be heading into Madrid tomorrow and wrapping up this race and also the season. Been very long and different for everybody this year, and just super grateful that we could have this race and be getting to do what we love. And I think this is going to be a really good building block, having this 3 weeks in the legs for the coming seasons with Mitchelton Scott.
Well, as those of you who've listened to the podcast for a few years will know, we have a relationship with LACA, the bike insurance people. They've advertised in the podcast for a few years, and we have a different relationship with LACA now. If you sign up to LACA, you will be supporting the cycling podcast. It's a community of cyclists where your premium is set by other claims made by other customers. And LACA have had so many cycling podcast listeners sign up as customers that they've set up a cycling podcast community within the greater LACA community. So to become part of that community, go to laca.co.uk and enter the code TCP, and that will put you in the cycling podcast community within LACA. Thank you very much to LACA. Now, we're going to tomorrow night obviously be looking back on the Grandest Tour and reflecting on it, as well as tomorrow's stage in Madrid. But one thing that struck me watching today's stage was how the countryside, the landscape looked absolutely beautiful. And partly that was the light. You know, we're into November now. The light is different. And one thing that struck me watching the the climb today was how few riders were wearing sunglasses, and we could actually see their faces. You know, we could see Sepp Kuss trying, and it was just a different view of cycling. And I'm not suggesting that we always hold the Vuelta in November, but it has, having the race at this time of year, it has created something a little bit different, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has. And I think, you know, traditionally the Vuelta has been the race that, you know, it's the hottest of all the Grand Tours, you know, especially when editions start down in Malaga in the, you know, end of August, and you're seeing temperatures up in upper 30s, lower 40s. But this year, you know, today when I turned on, opened up my computer and started watching the race, and I was thinking, wait, I have a distinct memory of that stage and climbing up to La Covatilla and just being incredibly hot, and, you know, going back to the car and just dumping bottles on myself. And to see, you know, even a rider today like Marc Soler bridging across to the breakaway in booties, leg warmers, arm warmers, you know, it almost reminded me of, you know, a stage of, you know, the Spring Classics or Paris-Nice, because we're at, you know, the complete opposite end of the season. And you also have to wonder, you know, we've seen the riders, you know, obviously Roglic, you know, won the race, but it's, you have to wonder, you know, did it maybe favor riders who perform better in cooler weather? And that's something that, you know, it does play a factor. There are riders that are, you know, regularly struggle in, you know, poor conditions or struggle in hot conditions. And, you know, that those conditions definitely play a factor in racing.
Just as you mentioned, Marc Soler bridging across to the break there. I mean, it was mind-bending tactics from Movistar today. I certainly couldn't get my head around what they were doing. Obviously, they wanted to get Soler up there, didn't they? So they were chasing hard, and then he bridged across and he had a bit of help from Emmanuel Viti, but then surely would have known.
Yeah, I think they were just trying to win the stage today.
Well, I know they were.
I think they were. But at that point, the break had quite a long, a big advantage, and they were wanting to get it back within reach. Putting Soler across to it was a decent tactic, I thought. I mean, I think ultimately they would have liked Mass, and I think Mass himself would have liked to have won the stage. But, Enough dumping on Movistar. I've been quite impressed with them at this Vuelta. You can question their tactics, but
I didn't know what they were trying to do. I was asking the question: was it to try and to bring it all back from Mass, or was it to try and get Soler across to win the stage,
or both? They did get Soler across. They put him in with a shout of winning the stage. He wasn't able to do it, but I mean, I think they've had a really poor season, and I think they are a team in transition. And I think the way that they've raced this Vuelta has been quite impressive, because they have been riding like the, you know, like it is their national tour, with a lot of pride and trying to make a real impression. And I think they have done that. They've probably won the team classification. Let's not forget.
Of course,
well, they have.
I mean,
always
two riders in the top 10. And Mass, I think Mass is kind of a lot of pressure on him going to that team as leader from De Koenig Quickstep, where there's a lot less pressure on you if you're a GC rider at De Koenig Quickstep. That's a big responsibility, and I think he's actually done all right this year. I mean, fifth at the Vuelta and fifth at the Tour de France is not a bad return for a 25-year-old rider, I think.
Not at all. I wasn't dumping on Movistar there. I was trying to work out what they were doing, because I think getting Soler across, knowing the severity of the final climb and thinking that he would then be able to ride off and leave the other riders from the break behind and win the stage, I just felt like that was asking an awful lot of him, something that he wouldn't be able to do. But they didn't bring the gap down enough to then make it a race for the stage win among the GC riders either. So
Wait for series two of Least Expected Day. And then we'll find out. Maybe Soler was not supposed to do that. I don't know.
Then we'll see in the documentary three riders all give three different accounts of what they were supposed to be doing.
Well, just before we wrap up tonight, a reminder that we will be, our next week's episode will be our press conference episode. If you have a question for any of us, including Ian or Lizzie Banks or Francois Thomazeau, please, or Daniel Freeb for that matter, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com and send an audio file. We've had lots of questions already. I think you and I have probably listened to at least one of them, Lionel, judging by your reference to a rider going backwards or not earlier. Am I right?
I haven't actually, no.
All right. Okay. Interesting.
No, but it's, okay. It's something. Oh, well. It's something that I pointed out once during the tour. I think that the phrase "he's going backwards" or "no one was going backwards."
Well, we've had a very interesting question along those lines, so we'll save that for next week.
But it's the sort of the lexicon of cycling, isn't it? What we say without realising that they're not going backwards.
No, I mean, there's lots of things in the cycling lexicon that are not literally true. People don't eat their handlebars and they're not literally on the rivet, are they? What other things are there?
And they're not pedalling squares either.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I've been known to pedal squares, that's for sure. But yeah, we'll be back tomorrow with Ian again for the final episode of the Grandest Tour. And we have other things coming up. I mean, we'll go back to our weekly episode. There'll be another episode of Explore soon, will there, Lionel?
There will, yes. Yeah, it's going to be a bit of a mashup of... Well, you've all been out cycling and doing things, haven't you? Ian went bikepacking. Richard, you did your ride in northern France. Hannah Troop rode from Montpellier to Mont Ventoux. And Felicity Cloak, who we heard from at the start of the year, rode coast to coast. So sort of an audio diary compilation of just people out cycling and enjoying being out cycling, which feels, as winter closes in and as some people are again locked down, it feels kind of, let's just celebrate being able to go cycling.
Lionel, I'm surprised you didn't ask me to do an audio diary on the fishing trip.
Yeah, I missed a trick there, didn't I?
Next year.
What I learned last night when we were talking after the episode was that No fish were harmed in the making of this fishing trip. I assumed you'd be catching your fish and eating them, but you didn't eat any of them.
We did not know.
You put them all back.
We put all the fish back, and we were fly fishing, so the hooks are, well, I'm not a fish, but relatively unintrusive to the mouth of the fish. And my brother, he guides professionally on that river, so by catching the fish and then eating them, we're kind of diving into his livelihood. So we decided to let the fish go and hopefully to be caught at another point later in time.
I just assumed you'd be barbecuing them by the side of the river. But anyway, another time maybe. We should wrap things up. I was going to say as well, for friends of the podcast, we've got some good episodes coming up, including my extended chat with Teo Gegenhart, running through his win at the Giro, including the whole build-up and his disappointment at not going to the Tour. It's a really interesting listen. And that will be out for friends of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. In the meantime, thank you very much to you, Ian.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, guys. Last one tomorrow.
One more push.